Correct, yeah.
Well, we should save this.
Anyway, save it. Well, I mean, we actually probably better just get rolling.
Okay. So this is the second half, I guess, of the stuff on cap. I still have leftover handouts, so I'm sure you probably. You brought your handout.
Hey, I'm well trained.
I forgot to bring my handout.
All right.
It's almost enough, probably. Those are the ones we didn't get.
So Drew, this was the article.
Can't see that far.
Although we sort of got to sort of freestanding discussion.
Yeah, except that I still want to talk about that vitalism thing.
I just want to maybe finish up on the third thing, think about holes, not finish up, but say a couple more things about sums and parts. I was trying to think, I mean, I think I'm still interested in trying to get a version of the whole is more than the sum of the parts such that someone could actually deny that, you know, that is there any, can we interpret something just being the sum of its parts in a way that there are such things, you know? Could anyone ever claim this is just the sum of its parts?
Yeah.
It seems without that, it seems like there's nothing terribly interesting about denying
it. I just think it always comes down to levels.
Well, I don't think, if they don't have any interactions.
But are there any parts?
Among the parts.
Like the bricks in a wall is usually the standard example, right? And the point being that, sure, of course, it's bricks plus mortar plus bricks, but no brick gets changed as a function of being, although that's probably not true from a purely physical point of view, right?
That's
there's
totally
weight
not.
Forces
yeah.
and things. But
yeah.
but the metaphor certainly is that the brick doesn't change in its fundamental quality as a function of being part of the wall.
Right, and if we allow, and as we said last time, we need to allow relational properties of the parts, because obviously it matters how, you know, not all arrangements of bricks are walls, but if we
right.
allow that we, with each
right,
brick,
I mean,
he specifies position.
Well, I mean, I think this, you know, the as we talked about last time, the issue really comes down to a semantic issue. When you're talking about sum, are you talking about, you know, straight linear summation, or are you allowing for some more complicated process
right.
that's not purely
like
additive? And
like
if you take this is only purely additive, then certainly the statement is challengeable in a variety of different ways. But if you take a broader meaning of the word sum, then
right. The question is whether there's a middle ground there, because if you make it too broad, then it seems like you're in danger of allowing so much stuff in that you can say enough about the parts. For example, you take your favorite emergent system, you could just include it, you know, for each part, it is a part of a system whose holes have these properties, right? And therefore
yeah.
you would not get anything surprising. So is an ant,
right, but I thought
is
you were
an
ant say
in an anthill which exhibits foraging behavior, right? Well, if you pack that in as a property of the part, then the foraging behavior of the whole, or whatever it is, you know, exhibit.
It's still some. Right. How did you say what you repeat? How you started it? Where you said you were interested in either doing some,
getting a version that someone could deny.
That someone could assert about something. So getting a version of here's something such that it's a whole thing that is merely the sum of its parts.
No, but you did it the other way. So you said it that you wanted to find something where you could show it wasn't the case that the whole was more than the sum of its parts.
Right. Well, that's
And so I thought that was a strange way to say it, because in my way of this very wide view of the word sum, I think it is somewhat semantic / vacuous that to find something where the whole isn't the sum of its parts. See what I'm saying? I mean, to me, with my essentially vacuous meaning to the word sum,
what you mean?
It's
broad,
so
broad
that it's
right.
it's.
Right. So this is my problem.
Yeah.
So
then we get,
on the narrow interpretation,
we get to this.
On the narrow interpretation, nothing seems to be just the sum of it.
Yeah, right. We totally agree. It's
right.
not, I mean, except arithmetic.
On the broad
yeah.
enough interpretation, maybe everything is. So,
right.
I mean, maybe we should come back to Rob's example from last time of the putting out fires example. So I was trying to think what a reductionist should say there. So the example was, how about a property like water putting out fires? No water molecule can put out the fire, right? This is the thought. Whereas it's only the property of putting out fires is only something that applies to certain large enough conglomerate aggregations of water, and therefore it's a property of chunks of water that isn't a property of its molecular parts.
Well, I wonder actually if a molecule of water could put out a small enough fire. You know, the problem may be that your fires are bigger than molecular.
What's a question of levels and levels of description?
I mean, could I create a small enough fire that a molecule
could you create a molecular fire?
But you could create water.
What would a molecular fire be? I mean,
it'd be just a tiny, tiny one.
Yeah, but I think, no, I think there are the lower limits though.
The oxidation of a single molecule, that would be a tiny fire.
And that would be a tiny fire.
But if you break water into HNO, then that's not gonna be a fire.
But it occurs in water, you know, respiration, so I'm just thinking when you get down to that level, I'm not entirely clear that that's.
You break water into HNO and now you contribute to the fire rather than removing it.
How you would distinguish at that level between the oxidation of a single molecule and things happening inside the molecule, you know what I mean? I mean, it just seems to me there would be a point.
Well, and also it may just be false that the wood puts out fires at that level. I mean, water causes, water causes oxidation, you add water to fire.
Maybe we can come up with a simpler example that doesn't have to do with molecules. I was thinking of something we mentioned maybe a year ago, a marching band. And so if you imagine them marching in lockstep, then that doesn't seem to be a very emergent, there are no emergent patterns. But, well, there are, but they're very predictable, and we wouldn't describe them as being emergent.
If you knew what each person was doing, you could...
You knew the rules, and you know, state...
You could predict what the whole...
Yeah, and so they march, and they continue marching in lockstep. But if you have just slightly different rules, then you end up with very different patterns, and you might then want to describe what the pattern that comes out of it as being more than what you had before.
But it's still predictable.
Yeah,
you
I
know,
think
when they set up their elaborate patterns on
no,
the
No, if it could be like Langton's Ant, then it wouldn't be predictable in the
if
sense
you set them up like a CA
you
of
gave
some kind.
That would be cool.
If you said, if you said to the trombonist, you know,
like
if a person with a
Michigan
trumpet is next
there.
To you and takes a step to the left, you do.
But there's no sense of predicting it other than running it to see what happens.
That was because the halftime's not long enough, but that was...
Actually, you know, that's really what the Caltech marching band ought to do is like, you
right,
know,
just
rule
have, like,
30.
That would be so cool.
That would be fun to watch. But I guess
Caltech
that
doesn't have a marching
I know.
Band.
But I guess that's
speaking
the sense I think of when I think of being more than what it was previously, but than just marching in lockstep.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, I mean, again, trying to think what the reductionist would say there would be probably. That what you pointed to is a difference in the complexity of the properties of the whole, but it's not clear that there's some qualitative, you know, when do we go from more, not having more to more, right? In this case, it seems to be the limit of human tractability or something like that, which may be how you want to end up defining it.
I wonder if the middle case distinction wouldn't be between systems where the properties of the whole alter the parts, and systems where the properties of the whole do not. In other words, systems where there's some kind of feedback from the whole into the parts and systems where there isn't. I mean, that seems to me that might be a distinction we could actually make in practice.
So is that Stigmergy then?
Yeah, well, not necessarily. Stigmergy would be one case of it, but I mean, there would be other, there would be cases that would be, let's say, properties of the whole altering the internal rules or genetics of the parts, but that until the whole manifests, that doesn't happen. You know, until in a sense the parts are all doing something, the property that alters the parts doesn't appear.
Right. One really good example of that is that simulation of bird flight. Who's the
Right.
Was it
Boyds?
Boyds. Where the rule that the individual voids follow is a function of the behavior of the whole flock.
Yeah, that's right.
I was also thinking of like symbiosis between an organism, coral reefs.
I thought it was just the bird next to it.
No, there's, if you look
at algae, do one thing,
and
when they're with the hydra, they do another.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know? Like if they can be expelled from the hydra, and algae can be expelled from there and grow a flagella and live autonomously. But they don't do that when they're with the hydra and they're in a coral, you know. So it seems like the combination of the two changes
right.
one
or
of the members,
I mean,
or the animal element.
There are fish groups where they have fairly elaborate rules for switching gender at certain point in their life cycle that are determined only by whether the group is large enough, what the distributions of gender in the group happen to be at the time. And I think it has to do with environment.
I mean, how does the individual fish?
The individual, I think basically the individual fish has a kind of genetic rule about gender switching that has to do with size of group, composition of group, but also I think it's environmental. I know it has to do with temperature.
Well, that's really worked out in fern gametophytes. It's density dependent. You can, that's been well established on little auger media. You know, they'll switch from being female to male, little gametophytes, depending on the density that they're sitting on the auger. So that would apply.
Yeah. So that might be, I mean, so then, but then in a way the challenge would be to find a case where that's not so. In other words, where the properties of the whole, you know, have this character of being a sum, so to speak, but they do not affect the properties of the parts in any fashion. I mean, the brick wall would, and I'm sure somebody could come out and say, yes, but, you know, the bricks get compressed and the bricks change shape. And, okay, but,
well, how about something
so
like, how about something this, like,
they don't
the Busley, Busby Berkeley... you know, extravaganzas where you have all the dancers out there, and when you see them from the side, you know, they're doing kicks or they're waving your arms, but when you see them from above, you get these very elaborate patterns,
right.
And that's the surprise part of it. But those patterns are having no influence directly on
that's right.
What
they're
the
not doing anything
doing.
To the dancers. The marching
right.
band. I mean, if whatever the marching band does that creates a pattern doesn't change the marching band. You know, they
yeah.
don't switch instruments.
So
this
whole issue is not. I mean, you can relate it to emergence. Is not an emergence specific kind of a question.
It's a systems theory
and,
question. It seems to me, which is a broader.
So if we do emergence, I think we established. Whenever we started talking about marching bands, that if there's a big director standing on a tower and everybody's got their little script and everybody's got little spots in the field and then they go to spots in the field, that's not emergence because we would say that's designed and blah blah, right? A top down. But this whole in some kind of conundrum, the marching band does exhibit that, right? Because the pattern is different than the individual tuba guy. And so there does appear to be, there's another level, I mean, you know, I would not call this emergence, but there's another level, and at that other level, you see a pattern that is not the same as the individual player.
I think
I would still call the whole is the sum of the parts, because let's take away all those players, and there's no pattern.
But I think Tim's right. I would augment the marching band example. So with a third case, so you have them marching in lockstep, you have them following simple rules, and maybe patterns would emerge if you watch it. But what Tim said was you could actually have rules, for example, if you're marching and you run into somebody three times in 30 seconds, then you do something else. So now that is where the interactions are actually, so the group as a whole is actually changing the individuals. So now you have this strange interaction between levels, the whole marching band and the
yeah, I'm not saying that you couldn't run marching bands on emergent principles. I mean, that was the
right.
Point.
No, but I'm
that.
Just
but
making
no.
But if in terms of this distinction between systems where the whole property of the whole alters the parts and not,
yeah.
Right.
I think, you know, the other distinction that strikes me that's foodling around in here somewhere is there are systems where the property of the whole is a property that requires an observer to perceive it. And systems where we might say that the property of the whole is not dependent upon perception by some observer. I mean, Paul, I can say this because Paul's not here, because Paul would immediately have lots of things to say about stories. But, I mean, you know, where, okay, the marching band example or the, you know, the example of the Busby Berkey film requires, the property of the whole requires somebody to see it. And in fact, in the case of Busby Berkey, they require you to be in the right place to see it. There might be systems where we could say there's a property of the whole that appears when the whole system is functioning that is not dependent on anybody, you know, perceiving it. It's not a pattern. I mean, because all the properties of the whole that require perception are patterns that require a pattern-perceiving observer.
What world is this?
Where there are properties of the whole that aren't patterns?
No, that aren't perceived.
Oh,
they
but in other words, where they're not
perceived.
Dependent. In other words, there would be things that systems do potentially that strike me as properties that would not be dependent upon whether somebody sees them or not. genes working together.
Lactobacillus can't create the patterns it does if there's nobody around to perceive it. It's a persuasive idea initially, but I think the point is the pattern, the structure, the organization has to be there in order for it to be perceived. Whether it's perceived or not, whether it's named or not, is a separate issue.
But
I think there's something to Tim's point. I think what he's trying to, how I interpret it is that in the case of the marching band or whatever, trying to create a pattern, the point of it, the pattern is only significant insofar as it's perceived. There may be it doesn't have any other effect on the environment other than on perceivers. Right.
But it could have an effect on
the system
as itself.
Right.
I think if you combine what Tim just said about having something to perceive it, we're really asking, does the system do something? And the only thing it might do is actually affect itself. But that's still something.
Like, okay, gnats. Okay, gnats flock. They have a flocking behavior that's a lot like, what Boyds is trying to model. They do it because it has something to do with their reproduction. You've seen these clouds, where they're kind of moving in and out of this complex.
So is that why they do that?
Yeah, no, it's reproduction.
I thought it was just to get me irritated.
we see it, we see a pattern that's interesting, but to some extent, if nobody's seen it, the property of the whole, the thing that keeps them all together, has an effect on the parts that's independent of whether anybody's watching the gnat swarm or not.
But what's an example of something where that isn't
counter
true?
Example.
Yeah. It seems like that's true in any case, but in all cases.
That's
yeah.
Exactly the marching band.
The Busby Berkeley film.
Everybody might not know what
that
is.
Yeah.
Has everybody seen Busby Berkeley films?
Yeah. These
I think
fabulously complicated musical numbers with lots of swimmers and it looks completely like just a
just
musical
like,
number from one
angle.
Yeah, but that's not. But that's an example. That's an example of a case where the whole doesn't affect the parts. I'm talking
right.
about
right.
in any case where the whole affects the parts.
Okay.
You don't need a perceiver.
I would agree with that. But I'm saying that the property of the whole in the case of the Busby Berkeley film is a pattern. The pattern only matters if somebody's watching.
Right.
But you're saying it's dispensed.
You made
it's dispensed by the first
right.
distinction.
The first distinction
okay.
is a crucial
yeah.
one.
That's true. Yeah, that's emergence without a purpose, except for
right.
us watching it and
being entertained.
That's
the only type of emergence. I'm just being Paul there.
You're right. Thank
well,
you.
Let's go back to the level thing, because there's a standard, well, not standard, but there's a common objection to people who don't like this causation between levels. Right? There's a certain sort of reductionist who says, yeah, lower level things can cause higher level things, but higher level things just can't cause lower level things.
That's
because if you're, so the idea being that if you're a reductionist, the higher level things just are lower level things, so there's nothing separate to do causation.
Yeah.
And so,
of course.
So they would take the example of, say, the marching band reacting to other people around them, is saying exactly that. There's feedback, but what it is feedback between someone and their neighbor, or someone and someone they're interacting with, so that it's misdescribed as a property of the whole affecting the property of the part. What
yeah.
it is
of course there's no such thing as water. That's just
I think it's a deeper point than that, just that there's a claim that there's something incoherent about the notion of a property of the whole affecting the property of its part.
But that's clearly whether it's true in the case of the marching band described that way, I don't know, but suppose you put a television camera above the field and you gave each marching band member a little screen on their helmet, and when they saw certain patterns they were supposed to behave. And only when they saw these overall patterns. I mean, you certainly can come up with examples where it is the where the interactions of the whole provide information which is fed back to the individual units.
But you don't have to go
behavior.
That far. I mean, you don't have to see the whole thing in order for the group to.
Well, I would agree with that. But I mean, in the extreme, you could certainly look at the whole pattern. But the key is information feedback, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the interactions at the higher level have to provide information which the individual units can.
Right,
to guide their behavior in certain ways.
But the person making Alan's objection would still say
made to the part.
Yeah, they would still say that
it's
still the property of the part that is the lower level, quote unquote, that's actually the thing that is determinant, that matters.
But it misses,
doesn't matter if it's
but it
if
misses context, right? The part by itself is irrelevant. It's
but I think that's the really critical thing. When you talk about the whole being more or only or whatever is the sum of the part, as you said, the context is that sort of statement neglects context.
I guess it really comes to play when you start describing, say, now instead of talking about individual marching band people, we start talking about the band as a whole, and the band does this, and the band does that. Even though if you go to a reductionist explanation, you wouldn't talk about it. And in fact, you can't. You can't have rules that talk about, well, the band will do such and such, because that's just an approximation of what it will actually do. So you have to reduce down to the individual band members.
Well, that's the difference between ontological reductionism and epistemological reductionism, right? That the ontological claim, which I now sort of coming to the point like, who cares, is that you could, that the complete description, does anybody disagree with this? See, this is, I think everybody is an ontological reductionist, otherwise you're a mystic. That the complete description of whatever is happening is at some very, very tiny, tiny level. Now, the question is, what's the most, so that's ontological. Now, epistemological is how can
if you're talking about descriptions, de facto, you're in the epistemological realm. Ontological is about what really is.
Right, so I'm saying what really is individual people doing something based on whatever complicated thing. How we might best understand the thing called the band, that which is description, I would say,
yep.
is that's a, to me, a completely open question, right? It might be the best way to understand it is to understand the individual band member and their motivation, but it might be the best way to understand the band is to look at the diagram that the band leader has right in front of him when he's ordering people around. I mean, you know, that to me is a completely open question as to what's the quick, because I'm lazy, so what's the quickest, most powerful, easy way to understand the band. I don't want to have to go down to every individual little band member and see what they're doing if there's a higher level at which I can understand it. But that's epistemological. What I'm trying to say, and this is maybe we should get to the surplus meaning, my view is there isn't, in the complete description, so now we're back to the ontological part, maybe I should use the word description, in the complete something, it is just these individual parts. So that's what I call, you know, ontological reductionism, that the complete description, the ultimate description, which is probably impossible in pretty much anything,
no, but
which
you,
is why I may say, what's the point?
But
the complete description would be down to individual parts. Otherwise, there's a mysticism. There's
no,
something
you're
that's,
right, but what we, I think, agreed last time is that you can sort of pick any point in the system, and you can talk about emergent things below it and above it. For example, what if you have multiple bands now? And you could talk about, so you have these band contests, or they
Battle of the Bands.
Battle of the Bands. And so now you have 20 different bands, and each band is following its own rules, and they interact. And so now you could start talking about those interactions.
Sure.
And you could have approximations and rules.
So you can
and
see you're a computer science guy, because now you just have subroutines, and now you're making a routine that's got a bunch of calls on a bunch of subroutines.
No, but I think, I believe you that if you want to understand everything, you have to go down to the individual band member. But you can also
but
really
if you only
nice
focus there, you miss the upper level.
Right, you don't.
But in a brick and a wall, you don't. If you go to the
pattern,
it has everything.
You know, like biology or chemistry.
Sure. I'm not sure this is a useful discussion, actually. I'm now more or less convinced that. But there's two different claims. One is how to understand something. And there's a reason I come to these sessions. There I'm totally open to the view that there are levels. I mean, I do macroeconomics. That's there's two different schools of thought. There's the reductionist school, which I'm not a part of. That the only way to understand macroeconomics is by looking at the individual person and adding up all the individual people. That's the school I'm not a part of, because I think that's an impossible, in the foreseeable future, way to behave. Way to understand things. But you know, the other part is there are concepts or entities at a higher level, like unemployment, inflation, the budget deficit, trade deficit, that are meaningful just by themselves without having to go down to the individual. This plays out every day in my actual subject.
But the key question
but you're saying ontologically,
are they concepts or are they phenomena, or are they both?
Well, I would say we treat them as phenomena.
Yes, but you're saying that's an epistemological hack of
what is ontologically true.
Right.
Now, it's ontologically, you're saying you think unemployment doesn't actually
exist.
That's
what we're accused of. We're accused of being epistemological hacks. There's a guy with
the
Nobel Prize, Robert Lucas.
Computer hack, not hack in the
sense
of.
And his biggest complaint about the people like me is the phrase he uses, that we're ad hoc, which just means epistemological hack. That we just sort of, you know, we haven't derived everything from the individual person. So if we have 300 million Americans, we haven't derived American GDP from the behavior of what was happening to every one of these 300 million people.
Have you looked at the Nagle chapter on emergency leadership?
I probably did that
because,
in college.
Because, I mean, that seems to me to be exactly analogous to the question, to the relationship of thermodynamics to statistical mechanics.
Right.
Goes through that discussion and that reduction very clearly. And that's where surplus meaning comes in. So the question is, I mean, you have the concept of unemployment clearly has meaning that cannot be completely exhausted by any infinite description of individual people. But, so that's one thing. But then there's the question of that's the epistemological side, right? But then the ontological side is there such a phenomenon as unemployment? Do you want to even consider that a real phenomenon?
Yeah.
And then it seems to me that's a clear case of emergency.
These guys on the other side say unemployment is just actually a propaganda device by liberals.
Well, sure.
But Alan was looking for somebody who would say things are no more than the sums of their parts, and you basically just said it.
Well, see, I think from an ontological, that's why I, from an ontological view, I believe that.
Okay.
But from an epistemological view, I think, I mean, you could have some phenomena where you could understand it by the small, this relevant part. But the things I study, that's not true.
But in currency, like, distributions and when you would buy currencies and sell mm-hmm. currencies, a trade deficit is a real thing. If a country has this huge trade deficit,
yeah.
you may, at some point, when that gets big enough, now that's top-down acting down on the individual, say, I'm not going to buy
any currency
anymore.
This happens every day, right? I mean, you read
so
the newspaper.
How is that reductionist? How can you say that property exists?
Well, because I was thinking the War of Iraq. So you have some 18-year-old who's thinking of joining the army, reads the newspaper, though lately you wouldn't find anything about Iraq, and it's kind of amazing, actually. And decides not to join. Right, so that's that's an emergent thing happening in Iraq. Top down, he reads the newspaper, changes his decision. Things like that happen every day.
Sure. I mean,
so
and your
now
camp,
my view is though you could, in principle.
But you're arguing from the other camp now.
No.
No.
Because
yeah,
in principle.
You have to imagine going in all possible directions from that, to,
right,
and
okay.
in every
you
place
have,
you go,
you
find
know,
another
the
individual.
Little
who wrote the newspaper?
Right.
Where did
it,
you know, what did the person writing
right.
the newspaper
right.
know, and how
right.
did they come to
right.
know
right.
it,
right.
you
right.
know,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
You just imagine from every place out from that
right.
one decision, you find an endless network
Loop
of individuals right. making decisions as individuals. You know, and
so
then
you
find all the things that go into an individual.
This is a very...
You can't do it. That's what
that's
he's saying.
That's the
epistemologically,
you
in practical terms, you can't.
So
but he's
if
saying
I,
if you could,
if, right,
you would find nothing
right.
but
individuals.
So if individuals.
I was an historian, I would describe the event I just described as I described it. I would say somebody read a newspaper, and I might then try to analyze why the newspaper had, you know, print, just like what I did. You know, newspaper is New Orleans 24/7 now. You can't find Iraq. And so you could describe all that, right?
Talk about
but
media,
account,
right? But
no,
I wouldn't be going
no
down to the individual, you know,
this
event
is interesting.
In Iraq and
this
the individual reporter and who the reporter was hanging out with, you know, and what their kindergarten teacher taught them.
This parallels
no
artificial intelligence.
In the principle ontological version, there would
right.
be no such thing as a war in Iraq. There are just lots of individuals
right.
who are
right.
doing
but then
similar
by the
things
same criterion,
at similar
there's no
times.
Such thing as life, because there obviously life is just non-life at base, right? So therefore,
right.
there's no distinction.
Well, right.
there's, no
well, there's
principle
distinction. Right. I mean,
but ontologically, it's just the behavior of a lot of things that by themselves wouldn't be life.
Which an extreme position of physics could say.
This
right?
parallels.
I mean, that life is
well,
not.
I mean,
but don't
a
you
maybe,
think it's an interesting question as to where all these chemicals
matters,
that
yeah.
are just chemicals. When they start behaving in a qualitatively different way that we call life.
Well, I think this is
right.
why
well,
traditional
but
artificial
in
intelligence doesn't,
that's the point,
doesn't
right?
work, because traditional AI tries to work at these high-level concepts, and they found that just, you can't make something intelligent that way, truly intelligent. So you have to go down to these lower levels where everything is just another agent, sub-symbolic process.
Well, it might be helpful here to move on to number four.
Because
I think it's actually relevant to do with this issue of concepts versus things when we're talking about reduction. And I think it's number four in the one about the gene.
So
Gutmann says somewhere, page 40, a gene is nothing but a particular part of a nucleic acid molecule.
It is, at one level.
Right. And then later he seems to say, it's true but not true conceptually. And I just wanted to argue that the claim a gene is nothing but this nucleic acid molecule is importantly ambiguous between what philosophers call token identity claims and type identity claims. So token identity claim is, this thing in front of me, this particular thing is a conglomeration of whatever, right? A type identity claim is, so take this cup. This cup is just a bunch of bits of cardboard stuck together, cardboard molecules or whatever.
That's type.
That's token.
So
no, that's token. This particular
token.
Cup.
Okay.
And then the type claim is cups are nothing but whatever.
The class of all things cups are nothing
this
but.
This is a type claim.
As opposed
to. So if I say a cup is nothing but X, that's ambiguous between those. Does it mean a cup, this thing?
So
or
the
does
type
it mean
ID,
cuphood?
The type ID is the class of cups.
Yes, yeah.
And the token ID
is
the more broken
thing.
Down.
Right.
No, the token thing is just
an
example.
In both cases, you're breaking it down. It's just whether you're making a claim for the. So if he
the
said genes are nothing, that would remove the ambiguity because then he's just saying that the type gene is nothing more.
So one
than
might argue, yes, a specific gene,
A
given gene is nothing but a part of a nucleic acid molecule, while also arguing that there's nothing about genehood itself that means it has to be there. I mean, because, for example, I don't know enough about the biology, but you might think gene is some sort of functional concept. So it's nothing in principle why genes couldn't be made of silicon or something.
Well, Mendel did that. He came up with this idea pretty much, and then later we went, it's made of nucleic acid.
That's
right.
True.
So
and I mean, that's important in terms it's a really important point that the concept of a gene was a functional one first that did something, and you could make mathematical predictions about information transfer.
I mean, that's
75 years before anybody knew what it was made of.
So that's a perfect example of levels of analysis, right? That Mendel could operate at a higher level, knowing nothing about DNA or anything, and he could have predictions that were perfectly fine. So I agree with that, and that's what I do in macroeconomics. But that still doesn't change the fact that ultimately there really were these nucleic acid thingies. Right?
But
so
is gene no longer a functional concept?
No, it's still a functional,
and
that's what
and
I mean about levels of description. The statement that a gene is nothing more than a particular chunk of DNA at one level is correct, but you miss an awful lot of the inherent information because you're looking at only one level.
Surplus meaning strikes again.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But
so where does the surplus meaning come from? What is this?
I'm not sure it's surplus. That's
well,
I guess
surplus
the
meaning would be in the description. It would be in the theory of the thing. But the reason it's there, presumably, is because properties, actual, real, honest-to-God properties, ontologically emerge at higher levels of interaction of agents, of simpler agents. You bring simple agents together, and something actually comes into existence that, in terms of properties of the whole, that are not
we
properties.
Have, we have genes that are exactly identical or more or less identical to bacteria, even. They're in a different context, and they become different things. And you know what I mean? So the gene is not just this nucleic acid, because we have genes.
Yeah, but now reductionists wouldn't have a problem with that, because just like with your algae guys. Because you would say, you'd have all the little, we'd look at all the little, and then we'd calculate. You need 15,000 other algae before it decides to say, ooh, what a cool group to belong to. Whereas you got 14,999, you go, ah, I'd rather be on my own. So, you know, that would still be, we'd still say, in principle, you could go down to the very bottom. But the thing about surplus meaning, which I think is interesting, is Rob's point, is that in principle, it's a thing, it's a true phenomenon. And so, Alan, you're the philosopher of science. So Nagel, right? So is that an uncontested statement? This chapter, which I am going to go read, is that an uncontested statement? Does philosophy of science agree with this thing?
What's the statement?
It's not, no.
Surplus meaning.
That there is, I know, in philosophy, I know. It's
that the reduction.
Post
that
this
the
chapter of Nagel.
The reduction
Nagel
is
a chapter. Can we post it?
Yeah, sure. I think it'd be well worth it.
Right?
It's a chapter called Emergence. It's the claim. I mean, now of course everybody read it, you'll find out that I'm misinterpreting it. But it's, as I understand it and remember it, it's the claim that the classical reduction of thermodynamics to statistical mechanics is affected by letting the term, i.e., concept, temperature, equal mean kinetic energy of molecules. But at the level of thermodynamics, the concept of temperature has all sorts of meaning that is not captured by mean kinetic energy of molecules. And so, yes, you can derive thermodynamics from statistical mechanics, but in fact, you wouldn't know what you derived in effect unless you were able to operate at the level of thermodynamics as well. So it's
Well, to go back to the gene example, I mean, one claim would be someone whose knowledge of gene was exhausted by the claims that it was some particular nucleic acid molecule, and therefore if you gave them something that made a radically different stuff, they just wouldn't be in a position to see that it was a gene, even if we found some creatures where that was functional as a gene.
If I can
as a gene.
Put this in a historical perspective. So there's this functional idea of a gene, and we knew a lot functionally about how these units of information worked based on Mendel and a whole bunch of other people. And then starting in the middle of the 20th century, there was a lot of effort to figure out what the actual material was. And the underlying assumption for a long time was it's got to be proteins, because proteins, you can make sort of an infinite number of kinds of proteins because you've got 20 different building blocks. And there was just no way in hell that something like a nucleic acid, which had four bases and this really simple structure, there was no way that information, the complexity of information necessary for life, could be encoded in a molecule like that. And it took some very smart people doing some extremely clever experiments to finally demonstrate unequivocally that the source of information for the idea gene was tucked away in nucleic acid and not in protein.
But it means nothing without the proteins, and you could argue almost that it's just a compression of the information in proteins, that they themselves sort
of... Well, you've got to read out the information, but the point is there was extraordinary resistance to the idea that this could be done in this molecule because it was too simple.
But see, okay, I mean, the one thing that seems certain to me then about this is that those people, in science or otherwise, who mistake an argument that they're having about epistemological reduction for an ontological argument are in big trouble. So that, let's say, Richard Dawkins goes all ontological and says, natural selection is really genes.
Right.
He says it's not, the level of competition or the level of selection is operating at the gene. I mean, it seems to me there's no way in this context to avoid him, there's no way for him to avoid getting trumped if he wants to make that an ontological claim by somebody who says, no, it's really the selfish quark. You know, I mean, there's no way to say, look, the bus stops right here and goes no further down and goes no further up, unless you're making it as an epistemological claim. In other words, that's the best place to understand this thing that has, you know, macro levels that it works at and other micro levels that make it work.
Well, that's good, because then there's things called memes, you know, the social gene. Are those being acted on? Ideas, some ideas stick with us.
So how do we allow,
don't?
How do we get
I
to the
to
point
really
where we go, memes stink, or we hate that.
Right, but I mean.
That's stupid, or genes are real. You see my point? I mean,
yeah.
I think that, okay, so there are concepts. I mean, I'm a big fan of concepts, so.
Use them all the time.
But the thing
I
is, how do you distinguish the bogus one, right? I'm a
No, no,
that's why I put it out there because...
Well,
bias predictive capacity, right? I mean, what else can we go on other than its usefulness for...
Yeah, and I think you'd have to say that memes are as real as genes,
well,
right? Does everybody agree with
that? Well, they're functional,
no.
Sort of.
I mean, aren't they just patterns and they have these predictive properties?
Well, that's just saying.
But
it's
unclear.
It's not really, yeah. It's not
have the same
predictive
powers.
Yeah, right. In other words, there's a set of sort of predictive ideas that they have to compete against, which strike me as more meaningfully predictive.
Oh, I'm not saying they're equivalent. I'm saying that they're real unto themselves in some...
Can I interrupt for a second? I have to go to class, but I'm wondering if Tim would be willing to move back
a
week, and if we could actually do the Nagel chapter.
That'd be great.
And read it
this week.
But I mean,
do you want me to post it, or do you want to post it?
No, it'd be better if you. I don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have an electronic copy?
Well, I don't have an electronic copy. I can get it scanned today.
Because in some ways, that actually gets at the last one. How are we to know, in a sense, when we have derived something that is insufficient to the surplus meaning that might be available to us if we understood it in some other way.
And he's fairly conservative, as you'll see, by the way, also, and very anti-vitalism and all of that, not surprisingly.
It is posted on the website.
Yeah,